Welcome to the Left of Lansing podcast with your host, Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. A, dare we say, entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how we can best make Michigan's political machine work for the people. And now, live from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of the Left of Lansing podcast. I'm your hardworking, no-nonsense, progressive host, Pat Johnston. No nonsense? Well, maybe not. The LOL podcast is a weekly podcast released on Thursdays, and it focuses on Michigan's progressive political movement. I'll highlight the work that progressives are doing to reverse the crooked crony capitalism trend Republicans caused for years, leading to Michigan to lag behind in education, infrastructure, and a clean environment. Sure, Donald Trump is in the White House, and there's only so much that we can do to stop him until November of 2020. That's up to, really, the National Democratic Party. But in the meantime, Michigan progressives are busy working to fix this state because accomplishing change here first can help lead to national change later. I'll explain how that's happening during this podcast, and that also includes the issue of guns. If you recall, last month, I brought up a study led by Michigan State University researcher Dr. April Zioli showing that states with strong restrictions on convicted domestic abusers from purchasing firearms tends to lead to lesser incidents of gun-related intimate partner deaths. Now, federal law prevents convicted abusers from obtaining guns already. However, there are several loopholes that some states are trying to close to further protect women from gun violence. That being said, Michigan, unfortunately, is not one of those states. I know, how shocking. Dr. Zioli will join me here in a few minutes to discuss some of the encouraging numbers that she's discovered about those states that are doing more to prevent abusers from getting a gun. Now, don't forget you can visit leftoflansing.com for additional thoughts and news items during the week. And if you visit Left of Lansing, you'll not only get this week's podcast, you'll also see the entire LOL podcast archive. Miss a podcast? Don't worry. They are all available on leftoflansing.com. And if you're on your phone a lot and listen to podcasts that way, Left of Lansing is available on iTunes, Spotify, Radio Public, Google, plus much more. And please, please, please give the podcast a 5-star rating if you can, even if you think an episode deserved like a 3 or 4 star. Just do your best Rick Snyder or Bill Barr and lie. Seems to work for them. You know, speaking of U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, I have to share this tweet with you, if you don't mind. It comes from Michigan's very own LOL GOP. Now, LOL GOP is a contributor for the remarkable Progressive Eclectablog site. If you follow Michigan politics, I encourage you to follow eclectablog.com. Chris Savage and his staff do a wonderful job over there. And Chris and LOL GOP also do a podcast titled GOTMFV. That's a great title. Give it a listen if you can. Anyway, LOL GOP quote tweeted Texas Republican Senator and oil and gas industry shill John Cornyn during the Bill Barr Senate hearings this week. Now, here is the Cornyn tweet. A.G. Barr gets the Kavanaugh treatment from Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats. Now, that was what John Cornyn said, to which LOL GOP responded, oh, man. He was held down with a hand over his mouth to the point that he feared for his life. Okay. It's pretty bad. I know that. But that's the point. I mean, it wouldn't be funny if it wasn't so true and so sad. Oh, Republicans. Watching those hearings, by the way, just solidified our belief that Republicans will always put career over country. They'll always put party over country. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham illustrates the very point. As he once denounced and derided Trump years ago, but now acts like a loyal lapdog for Trump. Career over party, party over country. It's the Republican way. It's the way Republicans have operated for years. Michigan Republicans knew their ideas and values would never win over the state, so they set up roadblocks to prevent Michigan from being a true democracy. They devised an elaborate and criminal scheme to gerrymander districts in a last-ditch effort to hold on to their majority in the state legislature. The Bridge magazine, by the way, can I just announce once again that the Bridge magazine rocks? It really does. They do some great work over there. The Bridge magazine over the last few years has performed extensive work showing how Republicans and their benefactors worked in secret, worked behind closed doors, worked in undemocratic ways, worked in illegal ways to hold on to power in the legislature. Now, I'm not one to read articles during a podcast because, you know, you can easily do that yourself. And so I usually paraphrase, but today I'm not going to paraphrase. I'd like to read a portion from the Bridge magazine story right after the election of 2018. Then it was titled, "Gerrymandered Districts Help Republicans Keep Control of Michigan Legislature." It was written by Mike Wilkinson. And here's what it says. Bridge magazine has published numerous articles showing the GOP and business interests joined forces in past redistricting efforts to pay for consultants and lawyers to ensure that districts remain some of the most heavily tilted toward Republicans in the nation. At the end of the day, those maps tend to favor Republican candidates, said Arnold Weinfeld, associate director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University. Despite typically getting less than half the votes in statewide races, Republicans had a 63-47 advantage in the House and a 27-11 lead in the Senate going into last fall's elections. Those leads shrunk amid heavy turnout for Democrats, but Republican majorities remain 58-52 in the House and 22-16 in the Senate. In the Senate, statewide Democratic candidates received 50.4% of all votes, yet Republicans control 58% of Senate seats. And in Congress, Democrats received 50.7% of all votes to the Republicans' 46.2%, but could only muster a tie. Okay, so that's from the Bridge magazine. Right there, ladies and gentlemen, you know, it's a lie to say that extreme alt-right viewpoints are popular here in Michigan. If they were, Republicans wouldn't need to resort to cheating and breaking the law to hold on to power. Thankfully, there were people who decided to stop watching from the sideline, who decided to stop watching a broken system protect the very few at the expense of the rest of us. The League of Women Voters filed a lawsuit against the Republican gerrymandering regime in 2017, and in that case, emails showed that the Michigan GOP performed every dirty trick it could in order to hold on to power. The National Republican Party sent the Michigan GOP a memo titled "Redistricting Essentials, Consolidating the Results of the 2010 Election." In that memo, the Republican National Committee says, "Now that we had a spectacular election outcome, it's time to make sure Democrats cannot take it away from us in 2011 and 2012. And boy, did they work hard to ensure that would happen. The Bridge magazine on July 25th, 2018, revealed even more of these emails. Please, let me read part of this story, if you don't mind. Emails have emerged in a federal lawsuit that suggests Republicans gerrymandered congressional districts in Michigan in 2011 to maintain an advantage over Democrats despite years of claims the lines are drawn without political bias. The lawsuit references private emails that allegedly show one Republican aide saying a Macomb County district is shaped like it's giving the finger to Democratic U.S. Representative Sandy Levin. And the person said, "I love it." Another email from a GOP staffer was said to brag about cramming Dem garbage into four Southeast Michigan congressional districts. And a third email, according to the Bridge magazine, a longtime Michigan Chamber of Commerce executive predicts the maps will keep Republicans in power for years and implies the 4th congressional district in central Lower Peninsula was drawn to the wishes of Dave Camp, a longtime Republican congressman from Midland who has since retired. We will accommodate whatever Dave wants in his district, wrote Robert LeBrant, who has since left the Michigan chamber and is now a GOP consultant, on May 18, 2011, to two Republican consultants and a camp staffer. We've spent a lot of time providing options to ensure that we have a 9-to-5 delegation in 2012 and beyond, said Robert LeBrant. All right, so I've linked to those stories on leftoflansing.com on the same page of this very podcast, and it's stunning. Please, please read how the Republicans blatantly gerrymandered Dave Camp's District 4 to bypass Democratic stronghold areas such as Saginaw and Bay City. Republican John Molinar now has that seat. By the way, I believe he was a state senator back when the maps were drawn, just saying. And that's how it was done. Elitist Republican officials hooked up with their buddies from other elite corporatist circles and conspired to thwart the will of the people. And with that power consolidated for an entire decade, the Michigan GOP steamrolled their agenda, leaving citizens with very little tools in their arsenal to fight back. Or did they? Yes, the GOP got to run Michigan like Kansas and Mississippi, only to watch it fall apart, only to watch it go into the ground. But groups like the League of Women Voters took the GOP to court, and the three-judge panel decided that the Republican gerrymandering of 2011 was indeed illegal. In fact, the court said it was a gerrymandering of, and this is a quote, historical proportions. I'll repeat that. Historical proportions. So now, the court says the legislature must draw new lines by the end of this summer, and that Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer has to sign off on those new districts. Ooh. If they can't come to an agreement, then the judges will have to draw the lines for them. Now, it's great news. Big news. Big, big, big news. But we can't celebrate just yet. Michigan Republicans, predictably, are appealing to the Supreme Court. The court is currently deciding on two other state gerrymandering cases, and the court could decide to issue a stay on this ruling, which is what I'm expecting, or Michigan will just have to adjust once the court issues its ruling in those two other cases. Remind you, it is a conservative court, so I am very skeptical. But all is not lost, whatever the court decides on this issue. Because remember, we the voters passed a ballot proposal called Voters Not Politicians by a 61-39% margin last fall. A rout for the people of Michigan. In 2022 now, an independent commission of four Democrats, four Republicans, and five independents will draw new district lines. It takes redistricting out of the crooked Republican hands and back into the people's hands. Ah, but again, don't celebrate just yet on that one either, because Republicans wouldn't be Republicans without trying to hurt the voting process. A Senate subcommittee voted last week to cut Democratic Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson's budget by $4.6 million, which would be used to fund this commission. Oh, beautiful Republicans. Michigan Republicans, ladies and gentlemen, they still have not learned their lesson. Democratic State Senator Jeff Irwin from Washtenaw County introduced an amendment this week to restore that funding, and he said,
you know, when the voters voted on Proposal 2, it was very clear in the terms of the change to our Constitution that this independent redistricting commission would be funded with new money. I think that if voters knew that this legislature was going to backdoor these dollars out of the department and essentially, you know, punish the Secretary of State and all of her employees for passing Proposal 2, you know, I think that they would have maybe asked us some questions, you know, leading up to this last election, because the intent of the voters was to fund this operation with new money, and I think this cut deviates from that and threatens to imperil one of our most important operations here at the state. So I offer this amendment. Thank you.
Thanks for doing what you can, Senator Irwin. Thanks for fighting for the people. These Republicans won't quit from trying to diminish the power of your vote. Don't let them. Keep supporting progressives who want voting to be fair and open. You see, they want you to get exhausted. They want you to give up. But thanks to people like Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, State Senator Jeff Irwin, the League of Women Voters, the Voters Not Politicians movement, and so many others, we're starting to turn the tide, regardless of what the Supreme Court decides this year. We are winning. Coming up, guns and domestic violence with Dr. April Zioli. And don't forget, to follow Left of Lansing on the Facebook.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. Rumor has it, if you want to get Pat really fired up, just tell him Ringo Starr is just an average drummer. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Now, back to Pat.
Believe this is already my 11th podcast. Where has the time gone? Wow. Remember, you can always reach me on Twitter. That's at Left of Lansing. Again, at Left of Lansing. I like to post a lot of things there, including my thoughts, and also retweet and like a lot of other comments that I see on the Twitter sphere. Again, that is at Left of Lansing. Well, last month, if you recall, I interviewed Aaron Roberts from the Michigan Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence because April was Sexual Assault Awareness Month. I brought up a study to Ms. Roberts during our discussion, and it was a study that was led by Michigan State researcher Dr. April Zioli. And it showed that states with broad gun restriction laws for domestic abusers appeared to lead to a reduction in intimate partner homicides. Now, Ms. Roberts didn't really want to share too many thoughts about the study, probably because she really hadn't seen it, which I understood. So I came up with this brilliant idea that maybe perhaps it wouldn't be a bad idea to bring Dr. Zioli herself here on the podcast to further explain her findings. Dr. April Zioli is an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University, and we are thrilled to have her on this week's Left of Lansing podcast. Dr. Zioli, thanks for squeezing in some time this week, considering it is finals week. I completely understand how crazy it can be during this week, so thank you very much for being on. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what inspired you or, interested you to decide to study the issue of gun violence related to domestic violence and whether or not gun laws designed to block abusers from obtaining guns really did lessen gun-related domestic violence homicides?
You know, I've been working in the field of domestic violence for now just about 20 years. I'm a policy analyst. I love working with laws, looking at laws, looking at the difference between state laws, and my interest intersected there. What I was seeing when I looked at domestic violence was that there are a lot of homicide cases, and the majority of them are committed with firearms. Now, firearm restriction laws, like we looked at, that, for example, say that if you're under a domestic violence restraining order, you can't have a gun. Those are population-level interventions. In other words, the states that have them are trying to make a population-level change affecting intimate partner homicide throughout the state. So I wondered, does it work? Do these laws actually reduce intimate partner homicide in the states that have them? And so that was the inspiration behind the study.
How did you decide to go about researching this specific topic, the study that I mentioned here just a few moments ago? I mean, I assume that you had to research gun laws in just about every state around the country. Was it that exhaustive?
It was that exhaustive.
Wow.
Yes. The years we looked at were 1980 through 2013. And so we had to know what laws were in place in every state, actually not in every state. Four states don't report their homicide rates to the FBI.
Okay.
So we didn't include those four states, but we had to look at 46 states every single year to know exactly what laws they had, which was a huge, huge effort. But we wanted to very specifically know what laws were in place and what differences there were between laws in different states. I mentioned there's the domestic violence restraining order, firearm restriction. Well, those laws differ from state to state. In some states, like Michigan, dating partners can be covered. So if you're dating somebody, but you've never married them, you've never lived with them, you never had a child with them, and you get a domestic violence restraining order against them, that person can have a gun restriction put on them. Hmm. If you live in a state that doesn't cover dating partners and they're just as abusive to you and you get your domestic violence restraining order, they won't be covered, you know, with the firearm restriction. So I wanted to know if things like that made a difference.
Well, we're speaking with Dr. April Zioli, who's with criminal justice at Michigan State University here on the Left of Lansing podcast. Well, what did you find?
We found that when these firearm restriction laws, these domestic violence firearm restriction laws, covered a larger group of dangerous individuals, intimate partner homicide rates went down in association with these laws. For example, again, when they covered dating partners, we saw a 13% reduction in intimate partner homicide in states that covered dating partners under the domestic violence restraining order firearm restriction. And when they cover ex parte domestic violence restraining orders, those are those emergency or temporary restraining orders that you get very, very quickly before there's an opportunity for a hearing. When states are able to put firearm restrictions on people under those emergency restraining orders, intimate partner homicide goes down by 13%.
Wow.
And when states also have laws that say that a judge can or must order a person who's under this firearm restriction to relinquish any weapons, any guns they already possess, we saw a 12% decrease in intimate partner homicide. And I should say Michigan does not have that type of relinquishment law.
No, it sounds like what you were describing in terms with Michigan is that we have pretty lax laws when it comes to this issue. Is that, would that be right? Comparatively, I guess. Sorry about that.
We do allow the firearm restriction on dating partners, and we do allow it on those emergency orders, but we don't have a relinquishment law, no. And we don't have a law that says that firearm restrictions can be put on people convicted of violent misdemeanor crimes or domestic violence misdemeanor crimes.
Doctor, I'm just wondering here, I meant to ask this a little earlier, but is there a number approximately or a percentage number of intimate partner homicides that result from a firearm? Do we have any hard numbers on that?
Yeah, this number has actually been increasing over the past couple of years. Right now, it looks like about 58% of intimate partner homicides are committed with firearms in the country. You know, that number was higher in the 80s and 90s, and then it started coming down. But we're on another increase right now.
Do you know why? I mean, why did it maybe drop a decade ago, but now it's back up?
Well, we thought that the decrease might be due in part to these laws that I'm talking about, but we're not sure. More research needs to be done to figure out what is going on so that we can intervene.
We're talking with Dr. April Zioli. She is an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. First and foremost, since we're talking about this subject, I just want to make sure that our listeners are aware. Federal law, there is in federal law, is on the book saying that those who are convicted domestic abusers, they cannot purchase a gun, right?
There is a federal law, yes,
okay,
that says that if you've been convicted of domestic violence, you can't purchase or possess a gun.
Okay. Now, is that strictly with in terms of a marriage or a relationship? What are the parameters there?
There is a relationship requirement. You have to be married, currently or formerly married, have a child together, or live together as husband and wife, essentially, but not necessarily married, or be a parent or guardian of that person. So again, dating partners are not covered.
Now, was that some of the controversy that came up last month? I brought this up a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, how Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell introduced a provision, I believe, to be added in the new version of the Violence Against Women Act. And first of all, before I ask the question, I just like to clarify something that I said, that the provision I said on that podcast, that the provision would prevent a convicted domestic abusers from getting a gun. That was already in VAWA. So I just want to make sure I correct myself there. Now, this new provision, in fact, would include convicted stalkers and convicted abusers. Is that correct?
It would include convicted stalkers, and it would also, yes, include dating partners.
Okay, so that's
and
big.
It makes, yes, and it makes sense to include dating partners. 20 years ago, when the initial Violence Against Women Act was passed, I guess 24, 25 years ago now, we got married at a younger age, right? So we didn't spend as much time dating as we do now. But as our marriage age is increasing and there are more divorces, we spend a lot more time dating, and not including dating partners as people who are potentially of lethal danger to us just doesn't fit what's going on in our country right now.
Oh, that's a great point there, Doctor. That's right. I mean, times are changing. So since times are changing, perhaps maybe the laws should change a little bit as well. Dr. Zioli, I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but it's just something that I thought of as I was researching for today's show. Have you or anyone that you know of done any kind of research to see how many people related to the victim of an intimate partner homicide are killed? You know, people who are killed because of their proximity to the victim?
Yes. You know, there have been a couple of different studies using different samples, but as far as we know, between about 6 and 20%, and I know that's a wide interval, but between about 6 and 20% of intimate partner homicides have additional victims. The most common relationship is child, so a mother and her children, for example. But parents, siblings, the neighbor, you know, are also killed sometimes in the midst of intimate partner homicides. And most of those, again, are committed with a gun.
With a gun, right. Is there a relationship, for the lack of a better word, a relationship of domestic violence with those who end up committing mass murder with a firearm?
We don't know yet. Okay. But what we do know is that over 50% of mass shootings are domestic violence events. So a mass shooter will kill their family. That's when we define a mass shooting as four or more fatal victims. So most of them are intimate partner homicides and additional victims or other family members. And we also know that there are some mass shooters who don't kill their intimate partners or family members who do have those histories, but we need more research to really figure out what's going on there.
How many states have passed laws that go beyond what we have federally here to prevent people who've been convicted of domestic abuse or violence from obtaining guns? Is there a number like 4 states, 8 states, 10 that have gone further than the federal government's law?
I would have to count.
Okay. No problem. But there are states. There are states that have gone further.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And the research bears that, as you say, that the stronger the restrictions, the lesser an incidence of domestic violence with a firearm occurs.
Yes, this is about covering people, you know, covering more people who we know are dangerous. They've been proven dangerous through their actions. The courts have said they're dangerous. It's about covering more people who are dangerous under firearm restrictions.
Are you doing further research into this topic? Did it stop there? Or are you continuing your work?
Oh, I'm absolutely continuing my work.
How so?
There's so much we don't know.
How so? What are you looking at right now?
So one of the things that I'm looking at right now is, gosh, a number of things. One of the things I'm looking at right now is how the people who have committed intimate partner homicide, despite these restrictions, how they're able to kind of slip through the cracks. What are the opportunities that we have that we potentially haven't used yet to intervene in people who commit intimate partner homicide?
All right. Well, and one more question. Are you hopeful that maybe with new leadership here in the state that something might be done to turn around some of the lax gun laws that we have here on the books for those who've been who have a history of domestic violence?
What I will say is that there's quite a bit of evidence on some of the laws that Michigan doesn't have that they might be helpful. So our legislators who are interested in saving more lives, it would be appropriate if they looked at that research and made their decisions based on it.
All right, excellent. Dr. April Zioli, an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. If anybody would like to find the study, where was it published, the study that we've been talking about here?
The American Journal of Epidemiology. But you know what? If you go to my webpage through Michigan State University, search my name, April Zioli, my webpage will come up and there's a link.
Oh, perfect. Well, you know what I'll do, Dr. Zioli? I will provide a link to your website on this week's podcast when I post it on the leftoflansing.com website. That way people can check it out for themselves by going there.
Great.
Thanks a lot for taking a couple minutes out of your busy schedule here to talk with us on the Left of Lansing podcast. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Thanks for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. Don't forget, you can contact Pat by emailing leftoflansing@gmail.com and visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information.
Thanks again to Dr. April Zioli for agreeing to be on this week's Left of Lansing podcast and for providing us with some hard numbers to back up the arguments that we need stronger gun restrictions against those who will harm women, especially in terms of domestic violence. Let's make sure to work on closing the so-called boyfriend loophole. All right, here in Michigan, can we do that, please? It's about trying to save lives. And as Dr. Zioli showed, the evidence is out there. The evidence is out there. It's pretty sound evidence, too, that we can protect those lives. Now, all we need is the political will. Time for the Left of Lansing last call. This is where I'd like to highlight some of the important work our progressive legislators and activists are doing to help Michigan. First of all, raise a glass for Democratic Congresswoman Haley Stevens from Rochester Hills. Stevens flipped a red district to blue last fall, if you recall, and before that, she served on President Obama's administration. Now, Stevens announced this week that she was signing on to legislation that would stop military courts from releasing rapists. Probably wondering what I'm talking about. Well, according to the Detroit Free Press, the Pentagon has been busy dealing with how to respond to an increased number of sexual assault reports involving service members. And the Free Press says that in May of 2018, almost 6,800 reports of sexual assault made in the previous year had increased by nearly 10%, even as scientific surveys had shown fewer service members experiencing sexual assault in recent years. Now, that as the background, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Services said it would apply a 5-year statute of limitations for sexual assault cases brought between 1986 through 2006. Huh? Now, it had already been established that there shouldn't have been a statute of limitations. So this has resulted in dozens of offenders appealing their convictions outside of that 5-year window, and some of those convictions have been overturned. So this new bill that Congresswoman Stevens is signing on to states that Congress does not believe the court should apply the earlier 5-year limit to cases after 1986, and that there will be no statute of limitations for sexual offenses in the military against children. Hear, hear. This bill should fly through the U.S. House, and I'm hopeful it will get through the Senate, but you never know with Mitch McConnell. That's the sorry, sad state of affairs that we are currently in right now in Washington. Thanks for fighting for the people, Congresswoman Haley Stevens. And finally, many of you know that I'm a huge fan of freshman state representative Lori Pahutsky. No, it's not because she appeared on this podcast, although that did help. No, I'm a fan of Representative Pahutsky because she ran a truly progressive race to not only upset her Democratic challenger, but to become the first Democrat to win her district in some 3 decades. The Livonia Democrat spoke recently at the People's Wave Convention this week. She wanted to give thanks to the Michigan People's Campaign, which gave her initial support to run for office when the establishment Democratic Party would not. Yes, we've got some great and fantastic national young progressive stars like AOC for sure. And I love AOC, don't get me wrong. But please listen to this speech by Representative Pahutsky and tell me that we don't have a future progressive leader right here in Michigan.
My name is Lori Pahutsky, and I'm a Michigan State Representative. Thank you. And a proud member of Michigan United and Michigan People's Campaign. Like many in my generation, I graduated from college in the wake of the financial crisis. Big banks broke our economy, and we, the 99%, paid the price. The jobs out there were not paying a living wage. There was simply no way to survive and pay off my student debt while working in my field as a scientist. So I spent a couple of years waiting tables, and I found that I was far from alone in my situation. I worked with teachers who couldn't make ends meet on their salaries and would close the restaurant at 2 a.m. to get back up at 6 to get to class. No. Our hourly wage was $3.25 an hour, so we relied on tips to pay our bills, and those were inconsistent. I was fortunate. Eventually, I got a job at a local laboratory so I could do what I loved. But that experience made sure that I never forgot what it was like to struggle. So then the 2016 election hit. You remember where you were when Trump won? I do too. I was sitting on my living room floor thinking about his violent rhetoric towards women and what that meant for survivors of sexual assault like me. Here was a man who insisted that it was okay to assault women and that bragging about it was simply to be expected. I remembered feeling like a second-class citizen, but I also know that there are people who have felt that way their entire lives. The fact that I had never felt it was a testament to my privilege. I'd heard and believed that people felt that way, but now I understood the need for urgency. I'd been afforded this privilege, and now I needed to do something with it. Activism was no longer enough. I heard the calls from across the country for people to move from protest to power, so I filed a run in March of 2017. That same month, someone told me that I needed to get in touch with Michigan People's Campaign and Michigan United. So I went to one of their 1.5-day trainings, and to my surprise, no one treated me like I was crazy for wanting to flip one of the state's reddest seats. Instead, they gave me the tools to do it. They explained the importance of running on issues and having honest, bold conversations about things that actually mattered. In January of 2018, I attended the Movement Politics Academy, and Michigan People's Campaign had asked me to apply. And that meant something because up to that point, no one had asked me to get involved or run. Here was a group that was working with a bold agenda and actually taking steps to enact it. They're performing direct actions to hold our leaders accountable and training and supporting people from the 99% into office. I ran because I thought that the people representing me and my community don't know what it's like to struggle like the rest of us. They don't know what it's like to neglect your health because you already know that you can't afford the medical bills. While they're drafting bills rooted in science, there wasn't a single scientist in the room. No one had the experience and perspective that I did. So what do you think that the powers that be in the Democratic Party did? They told me not to run. Who's experienced that before in your life? People who asked you not to take power that should be yours. But you know what? That's okay, because I wasn't asking for permission. And I'll tell you something great. Because I didn't ask for permission and because they opposed me, I was able to run my campaign the way I wanted to. I said that we need single-payer healthcare in Michigan because I've seen the people I love treated like a bottom line, and nobody's healthcare should be based on their bank account. I said we shouldn't just be legalizing marijuana. We should be expunging the records of people who were unjustly convicted under laws based in systemic racism. And I said that our environment was more important than corporate donors, and we refused to let it be destroyed in exchange for donations. And we won the primary, but the story was not over because I ran as a Democrat in a district that hadn't elected one since the 70s. So on election night, despite my anxiety, there was a level of peace that I felt because I knew that I'd run my campaign how I wanted to. Boldly, authentically, and with the power of the people. And lucky for me, when the results came in, I won by 223 votes. And that was awesome, but it could have gone a different way. We could have done all of that and ended up short. But you know what? We would have won anyway. Because we came out as an actual contender using the movement politics model. So regardless of the outcome, we had already won. So I want fists up in the air today for all of the people on stage here and everyone from the movement who ran, and if they didn't get their election certificate, they pushed the movement forward. We see you and we know you're gonna run again and you're gonna win. Now remember though, I ran without party backing. So you'd expect it to be a little rough when I got to the Capitol. But you know what, here's the thing. Elected officials respect power. So they put me on the Democratic leadership team. I was appointed assistant floor leader, and I'm not just there representing myself. I'm the Michigan United, Michigan People's Campaign rep in the House leadership. I know it's tough. I learned very quickly the only way to have a voice in government is to have a majority, so we need to operate outside and inside the system to make sure that we get our people on the inside and hold them accountable and support them once they're there. So here's looking at the MUMPC delegation. I'm going to be excited when more of you join me in the House. Thank you.
Did I say a future leader? No, let me correct myself. I'd say Representative Lori Pahutsky is already a leader.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wanderbeats. To hear more, visit wanderbeats.net. That's wanderbeats.net. Now back to Pat Johnston.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. Thanks again for joining me. Remember, throughout the week, if you'd like to check out previous podcasts, all you have to do is go to leftoflansing.com. We've got the full archive posted for you there, along with other news stories and commentaries throughout the week that I like to post there. Again, the website is leftoflansing.com. Very simple to email me, too. That is leftoflansing@gmail.com. Please let me know what you like, what you don't like about the podcast. I'm always open to suggestions. Maybe you have a guest that you think should be on this podcast. Let me know. Again, that's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Kentucky Derby is coming up this Saturday. I'm going with By My Standards. Remember that name, By My Standards. Telling you, By My Standards, going to win. 15-1 shot, I know, kind of a long shot for the Derby, but I'm going with By My Standards. What do I know about horse racing? Nothing, really, to tell you the truth. I just like the name, By My Standards. Everybody, please have yourselves a fantastic week. Keep engaged, keep informed, and remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston. Just kidding, this thing isn't researched. And broadcasted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance provided by the wonderful Dr. Heather. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information and Pat's musical taste, if you can handle it. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.